welcome to this special mountain talk. All of our mountain talks are special here on WMMT. And tonight we're going to talk with Joe Reinhardt, and we have Jonathan Hoopman and Sarah Pennington, and we're going to talk about co-ops as a way to one way to build an economy and to build businesses, to create businesses. And so hang in there with us. So Joe, you're here in visiting us here in Whitesburg, and tell us a little bit about what you do and the group you're with.
Yeah, so my name's Joe Reinhardt. I'm the Rural Programs Coordinator at the Democracy at Work Institute and the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. We're a nonprofit that works nationally to work with communities to help them implement worker-owned businesses as a means towards more sustainable and more long-term economic development.
And so there's a whole rural division of your work.
Yeah, the USDA actually has a grant program that they fund, the Rural Cooperative Development Grant Program, and that funds a lot of centers around the country. We work nationally. There's an organization called K-Card that works here in Kentucky that's funded through the same program to help people develop all sorts of cooperatives, farming cooperatives, consumer food cooperatives, and then worker cooperatives.
Yeah, I guess we folks might know some about some of the farming co-ops and all, but worker co-ops might be a bit of a foreign concept. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the best way to think about cooperatives is that they're regular businesses, but they're run really to meet the needs of their members, but they still compete in the marketplace, and they're owned by their members. And so in a consumer cooperative, that might be people consuming food, like wanting to be able to access food at a relatively low markup that is healthy and they can sort of guarantee where it's from. In a farming cooperative, that's always been about marketing products for people. It's been getting transportation, you know, back when the railroads were, railroads were just getting started, farmers used cooperatives to negotiate with the railroads, or farmers used that to buy fertilizer and buy supplies. And a worker cooperative is really about helping workers sell their labor in the market through a business that's meeting needs. It could be a restaurant, a manufacturing company, any number of things, a home healthcare business, sort of any, they can be in any industry, but it's really workers come together to sell their labor in the market in a business where they control both sort of the general management and the like ownership.
And are there examples of those worker co-ops in Kentucky?
You know, up until really recently, there haven't been very many in Kentucky. There's a long history of agricultural cooperatives and people cooperating informally in Kentucky. I think that in Appalachia, you just see a lot of people coming together to cooperate, but it doesn't really, they don't call it a business. They call it, that's how we do things. But now we've got three startup cooperatives in Kentucky this year, including this one in Whitesburg.
Well, great. So, Jonathan, Hoopman, tell us a little bit about, I'm assuming that you invited Joe, you and some partners maybe invited Joe to come to Whitesburg and talk to you. What are you up to?
Yeah, me and three other fellows, Josh, Matt, and Ben, got together, and we have been tossing around the idea for a record store and a music store in general for a really long time. And we found a great space in right downtown Whitesburg and decided that that would catapult us into action. And Josh was really the one that said, you know, I really feel like a worker co-op would be the best thing for us to do. And so I've had kind of more time and have really kind of dived into looking into what that means, because that's I feel like I'm probably in a very large demographic of I've heard that term, but that's about all that I knew about it. And so just got into researching them and was felt like that it would be a great model for us to do, in that one, it's a sound business model. It's not just that it's democratic or worker run or these things, that it is actually a sound business model, and that, you know, the democratic part is obviously something that we were all excited about as a for me personally, being I feel like I'm entrepreneurial minded, but I've felt paralyzed in that I've have been very critical of our economic system, and so felt very conflicted in participating in it. And so the co-op model just really appealed to me in that way. And so we been doing research, and you know, we come across the United States Federation for Worker Co-ops and saw that the Democracy at Work Network was a part of that and reached out to them, and they have an intake form that we filled out to provide help for startups, and that's how we got connected with Joe.
Great. Well, tell me, maybe Joe, a little bit about this whole notion of democracy. I mean, does that mean that in a co-op, everybody makes every decision and tells each other person what to do all the time? How does that work?
No, not at all. I mean, so really,
that's kind of like an Apple Shop's life.
Well, I think there are two things that are democratic in a cooperative. The first is the ownership. So everybody owns one share in the business, and that share costs the same amount. And usually, we have a principle of voluntary and open membership, which means nobody can force you to join a cooperative. But when you walk into a cooperative as the farmer or as the worker, you can at least see how to become a member. Mm-hmm. Not everybody who works in a worker co-op gets to be a member if you don't perform well, if you're a bad employee. There's usually a trial period, and they're not going to take you on as a worker owner. In the same way, at a farmer co-op, if there's not room in the marketing, if there's not room in the market, they're not going to take you on as a farmer. But I think the important thing is that everybody owns one of those shares, and you can see how to buy that share. And then you use those shares to vote for the board of directors. And the board of directors really does what's called governance, right? Uh-huh. Which is like the big picture decisions. Where is this company going? Are we moving this company across, you know, out of the community? Usually, given that all the shareholders live in the community, the answer to that is usually no, or almost always no. But so really they're voting on the democratic part comes into the big picture decisions. And then, you know, workplaces, every cooperative organizes their management different, which is the sort of day-to-day operations and who's doing the scheduling. But they all share sort of a participatory workplace where, you know, you may still have a boss telling you what to do, but you get to evaluate that boss every year. That boss is probably, you know, you've put in things in place where the boss listens to you because, frankly, it's smart business to listen to your workers at this point, to listen and say, hey, how can we make this place work better? Is just smart business. And then on top of that, if your boss is really bad, you vote for a board of directors slate that says, hey, let's fire this particular guy, or let's have more generally better evaluation and accountability for managers, because we feel like the managers aren't good.
So I mean, I guess I was thinking of how a corporation works, and you know, again, you can own part of it and you can vote for a board of directors and they hire managers and stuff, but I guess there is a difference. There are probably quite a few differences.
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference is, A, the shareholders are also the employees.
That's the most important difference.
But then also, I think, you know, if you look at the way corporate governance is done, you don't really, there's so many shares out there that you don't really have a meaningful say. Mm-hmm. And the corporation is, the primary desire of a corporation is to make money, and that's their legal goal. That's the goal that the law sets for them, and that's what they have to do. They have to maximize return to investors. And really what's different in a cooperative is that they ask a different question. A corporation asks, how can I make the most money possible for my shareholders? A worker cooperative asks, how can I make profit? If the cooperative doesn't make a profit, it's going to go away. So they're for-profit businesses. They're profit-driven. But the question they're asking is, how can we make a profit, meet a need in the market, and be really good to our workers? So it's just a fundamentally different question.
Cough for a minute. Sarah, do you work with KFTC, and we're in this period here in this region where we've lost a lot of mining jobs, over 7,000 just in the last couple of years, and people are really looking for, you know, what kind of alternatives there are. And I think many people are seeing that we're not going to get a Toyota plant to move in, or, you know, a big factory of some kind. So, you know, other smaller businesses, entrepreneurs, these kinds of things are all out there to on the table as possible ideas. So, Sarah, I didn't know if you had any particular questions about the co-op model. I know you've researched it a little bit yourself and participated in meetings.
Yeah, you know, we've been as an organization thinking a little bit about how worker cooperatives and other forms of alternative economic ways of doing things can help. You know, we're in a time of extreme transition right now, and how can the economy that we're going to be one that is better for all people and not just a few people that are getting the wealth coming from our region? And so, and thinking about a worker cooperative model as one possibility for that, because the folks that are local and in the region get to make the decisions about their work and about their job. And so I've been really intrigued by this idea of the one worker, one vote. So it's not a bunch of shareholders somewhere else making those decisions, but the people that are doing the work really having the democratic participation. And so my questions, I've got sort of big, large-scale questions about how we make this happen, but also have questions about, like, how does that really feel to the people that are doing the work to know that you really own your job and you're setting the course for your own work?
Jonathan, who's starting out at this?
Well, you know, right now we got this space, and it's, you know, we just call people up and say, hey, this is what I'm going to do. And we don't have a cooperative, we don't have our cooperative bylaws in place. So, but we are running democratically right now. So, but and again, you know, it feels good. It feels good to know that I'm participating in something where everyone has a say, everyone has a vote, and we are not influenced. I think, you know, one of the big things that Joe hit upon is that, like, we need to make a profit in order to survive, and that's a fundamental part of the business. But the big part of the larger part of the business is, how can it be sustainable for us in doing something that we love and also be a benefit to the community? And I think and to keep the wealth locally too, you know, so it's not heading out of the area. And so that feels really good, and it's exciting to come up. You know, Joe met with us today trying to teach us more about how it works, because there are a lot of different models out there, and we're not even sure exactly what model we're going to use as far as a worker co-op. We just know that we like the theoretical framework behind it. And so I guess that's the best way I can answer your question.
I mean, I think everybody probably listening knows how it feels to work in a worker cooperative, actually, because it's the feeling, at least when I did it, I worked in a coffee shop in Asheville, North Carolina, and we, closing up at the end of the day, you know, it was 11 o'clock at night, and I just worked 8 or 10 hours. But you look around, and it's the same feeling you get when you're done in your garden at the end of the day, or you're done working on your house at the end of the day. It's very much like, oh, this is mine. Built this. And for us it was, there was two or three of us closing, and we'd say, look around and be like, yeah, we built this with the rest of our, like, coworkers. And so it's a, you know, in worker cooperatives we see people get, they feel more empowered by their workplace, they learn sort of skills about engaging in democracy, engaging in a, you know, a robust debate in their workplace and having an argument that's productive. They feel a lot more empowered to speak up. And you learn a lot of skills working in a worker cooperative, because they, you know, if you're going to work in a worker co-op, even if it's a big one, you got to learn the finances of the business. And that sounds intimidating, but I'm using this line a lot lately. This guy I know just said it, and it said, the only finances that you see in a business is, it's all third grade math. You got to do the third grade math, but it's all addition, subtraction, and a little bit of multiplication and division.
That's great. Yeah, I'm sure it just can help you across so many areas of your life, you know, what you learn. I mean, going from a democratic workplace to you know, the ballot box and participating in the democratic electoral process and all of those things. What else, Sarah?
So we've talked a little bit.
This is Sarah Pennington.
Yes. We've talked a little bit about the wealth. You know, we mentioned that and not wanting it to leave the region and to stay locally and in our communities. So in a place that's always struggled with that economically, where does the capital to get these things started come from?
I mean, I'm not going to like running a business is the trick and financing a small business is a trick these days. It's a challenge. And I'm not going to lie, the worker cooperatives, you know, we need to be finding better pools of money. Like, so right now, every worker cooperative starts workers buy-in. That can be anything from $100. If you're starting a small company or if you're entering a small company, to there are some worker cooperatives that cost $10,000 to join, but almost always those ones are going to have savings plans or subtractions from your deductions from your paycheck. So it's like they help, the cooperative will help you save. So that's the number one place is that you got to put a little skin in the game. And then we run a number of, there's a number of loan funds run around the country that actually are specific for worker cooperatives. And then I think the last place is that really we need to look for more sources of capital for these businesses. And that means for our work, educating banks and credit unions about the fact that they're just as stable, in fact, more stable than regular businesses. They're a safer bet than a small business loan, we think. And then because there are added, in the same way that you get loan guarantees to coal companies or loan guarantees to other economic development tools, you know, on the policy level, we really need to be looking at how do we make loan guarantees for worker cooperatives that are not bad businesses. You know, we can't loan money to long shots or bad businesses, but if you're a worker cooperative, if you're going to create significant wealth in the community, if you're going to anchor jobs in the community long term, there ought to be in the same way, they ought to receive the same benefits as other large scale businesses that do the same thing and in fact do provide less reward for less in the long term.
And you said that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, has a program that supports co-ops, so or is somewhat interested in them. I mean, it sounds like there is some official policy kind of interest in this model.
Yeah, especially in co-ops in general, there's a lot of great agricultural co-ops in the U.S., and there's this network of rural development cooperative development centers. They operate through an organization called Cooperation Works, and KCARD, specifically for folks in Kentucky. KCARD, if you're in West Virginia, there's actually a Southern Ohio cooperative development center that runs out of Ohio State University that'll work with you. And similarly in Southern Ohio, which I guess is most of the listening area here.
We don't quite get that.
You don't quite
not
get
through
that
the
far?
Not through the airways.
Right.
Well, anyway, those are the ones that folks
maybe
could
Portsmouth, Ohio.
The ones that folks could find.
Uh-huh.
And then there's actually a lot of loan guarantee programs that apply both to cooperatives and to small businesses in rural areas that are run through USDA Rural Development. And rural electric cooperatives can request guaranteed loan funds from the USDA, which is an undersubscribed program. I'll just say if you're looking for a little economic development money and you know the local electric co-op, that you can actually work with them to help them. They can help you get a loan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more complicated than that, but there's that program out there.
Hmm. Yeah, and we really, I mean, in this region shouldn't be thinking of the cooperatives as a alien kind of thing, because we do have something like 16 energy co-ops in Kentucky, and we have many phone co-ops too, rural telephone co-ops, and their membership, they have members that vote and own them.
Yeah, I think every person in Eastern Kentucky must be a member of either an electric or a... No, I'm wrong.
No, quite a few, but there's a lot of for-profit utilities also that are
like
Kentucky Power.
It's mixed.
It's like electric co-ops cover 70% of the U.S.'s land mass.
Uh-huh.
It gets their power from a cooperative.
Right, right. And, you know, they're really, they came about because the for-profit larger utilities didn't want to serve rural areas. So I'm wondering, in your co-op work, and your rural connection, do you find that some of the co-ops are doing things that other larger businesses don't want to do, or they don't want to fool with rural communities, or that kind of thing?
I mean, I think it's a... I mean, I think that there's a level at which the cooperative model really does answer. It's a different question that it's answering. It's, can we do this at a profit? Not, is this the most profitable thing to do? So back when the rural electric cooperatives got started, you could lay line, you know, lay power line at a profit. People in these communities were willing to, could afford it. But it wasn't the most profitable thing to do with your capital. And so that's how you came to have all these cooperatives, is that people would rural folks would capitalize them, and then make money, you know, because electricity was just that much of a benefit.
Right.
And you see the same thing. You see in places, especially in worker cooperative, people come together in a hard economic situation when it's not maybe the most profitable thing to do to employ them. And they use a lot of home health care workers, use it as a way to stabilize their wages and stabilize their working conditions, decrease turnover. A lot of cleaning companies, when there's sort of informal economies of cleaning ladies that are easy to exploit, they can, and it's not profitable to run a cleaning company, or not particularly profitable for the investment, but they'll come together and form a cleaning cooperative, raise their wages, make their labor more sustainable, make their labor safer, you know, more hours per week. So yeah, you see a lot of people using it as a tool in the market, but not to maximize profit.
Uh-huh, right.
And I just wanted to kind of speak to, like personally, I'm sure people are wondering, like, maybe how we started our capital for our business here locally. And all four of our founding members, we all have full-time jobs. Well, maybe not so much me, but other ways in which to kind of help support our project. And two, I think I've seen, say, my brother, he has systematically taken all his investments he's had in the stock market and invested it locally. Because he knows that maybe it's not the wisest financial, like, greatest gain, like he was talking about, but it's a peace of mind, one, to be able to see, like, oh, this is actually see the community and it's benefiting, and to have a kind of a better say of your investment. And so I think that's might be a part of the puzzle with the cooperatives, is people maybe divesting in, say, the stock market and then reinvesting in these local cooperatives that might not have the biggest returns right away, but potentially, because it is a good business model, be less volatile.
Mm-hmm. And I'll take an issue with, I guess maybe not the stock market right now, but I do know that the local cooperative loan fund that runs through New England is a much steadier investment than the stock market, and it's a better investment and a safer investment than bonds. Like, they're quite proud of the fact that they're like a super safe investment.
Uh-huh.
And divestment is a big word right now. Like, my Twitter feed is filled with the hashtag divest, because just today there's a protest going on at Harvard University about students wanting that university to divest, to take their funds that they've been investing in fossil fuels out of that. And there's conversation that's really starting, but what are you going to do with that money instead, especially in regions like ours where we've been so impacted, and our economy has been so impacted by that. So I sort of have one of these large-scale questions for maybe Jonathan and Joe, you can answer too. So if there was a huge people that are divesting, taking that money out and deciding to reinvest either locally or in regions like ours, and a lot of money was coming in to help start worker co-ops, and say we started to have thousands of co-ops across the region, what can you imagine? What's your vision of what that could be like for Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia?
Well, that's funny, because I was just been thinking recently that I think, because, you know, I'm a product of Ohio and the steel economy and manufacturing, huge manufacturing, and you know I'm not alone in that cultural heritage, and I think our imagination is still very much linked to that, about what the economy can look like. And that we're looking for the Toyotas and we're looking for these things to kind of be the replacement. And I just think that it might benefit our imaginations to think of maybe some more smaller enterprises as opposed to one big industry that's going to provide jobs. And the neat thing about that is that it utilizes your creative capacity, I think, much more than a manufacturing job, and is more a life-affirming vocation in some instances, where again you do have your you feel like you have an investment in it, and like you said, you know, it's like your garden. And if everyone had their more people had their little gardens and were excited about it, that the creative energy could be, you know, just a huge benefit in many areas, including one of the cooperative models is that you are available. It's kind of like a credo. You're available to other co-ops that are looking for advice, and so it's not a dog eat dog world ecosystem from which you work within, but hey, we're all in this together. Economic ecosystem that I think is just more life affirming.
It's interesting. You were talking about people who work in homes, cleaning people and stuff. And I was just at a conference on the East Kentucky Leadership Council, and they had Ron Crouch, who's does a lot with data and statistics, and he was saying that many, many, many people in Eastern Kentucky are working in the unreported economy. And so they're bartering or they're working in cash. And this really hurts the whole economy. And those people are not, their money is not going in for their future Social Security and Medicare benefits. And so they are really going to be in serious trouble when they get ready to retire, because they won't have paid in. It seems like these kinds of cooperative networks could really help folks like that, you know, to come together and set up a system where they're getting paid on the books, and a win-win all the way around.
Yeah, I mean, I think cooperatives are really useful in formalizing the informal economy, if that's what you want to do. I mean, the hope, I think, is honestly many people do that sort of work out of a little bit of, sort of need, and then out of a desire to avoid the tax burden. But I think what the hope is that if you manage a cooperative well enough, you'll improve your efficiency well enough that you will see an increase in working conditions and an increase in pay, and mm-hmm. be able to pay your taxes. I mean, I think that would be the ultimate outcome there. I don't want to... I think in terms of what you want to see, it's really about beginning, you know, it's been a long process of depopulating and extracting the natural wealth, the human capital wealth of the youth of Appalachia, taking them out and not giving them good jobs here. And it's a long process, I think, of both sort of extracting as much wealth as possible from Appalachia. And it's going to be a long process of building wealth here, and I think that's one reason that we need really strong investment from national organizations and national sort of and statewide organizations about, like, sort of saying it's a focus to keep wealth in these communities. But when you look at what it's going to look like in the future, I think, you know, any business, any fledgling industry that we do have, that you all do have, tourism, agribusiness, like a little bit of agribusiness, I think there's definitely room for manufacturing here. All of that really, the wealth stays more solidly here, and the businesses stay more solidly here as a cooperative. I would just mention that one of the major uses of cooperatives in the U.S. right now is to convert old businesses where the owner's retiring into worker cooperatives. And I think that's in some of these rural communities. There's a couple of towns now that have converted their grocery store where there's 10 or 15 people work, but the owner's retiring and can't find a buyer. They've converted it into a cooperative with the help of some technical assistance people and a little bit of outside money and finding lenders.
Uh-huh.
But really, that's a valuable service that cooperatives, either consumer cooperatives or worker cooperatives, can play, is anchoring businesses that are, you know, the local grocery store, or the local bar. Like, there's a huge cooperative pub movement in England, actually, where they've been like starting cooperatively owned, or they've been buying cooperatively owned bars from their retiring owners, and that sort of creates an anchor in the community.
One really big need that we have here is for energy efficiency, to make our houses less leaky. Speaking of our wealth going out, sometimes it's very literally going out our windows and our ductwork. And, you know, I've been thinking about what would it be like, because these rural electric co-ops now have access to a lot more low-interest loans or grants from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for the first time ever to do energy efficiency. And so what if that work is done by rural electric co-ops, sort of bringing the, I mean, by worker-owned co-ops doing the work to help rural electric co-ops and other utility members become more energy efficient, and how great that might be.
Are there examples of worker co-ops where the worker owners are spread over like a region, or, you know, a two county area or something? I would think in rural areas that's a bit of an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I would point to, there's a lot of sort of cooperatives in the technology fields.
Uh-huh.
Where, you know, they work. There's, I think we have one member who has members internationally, but people have, you know, branches all across the country. But I think the best example there actually is going to be Cooperative Care of Wisconsin, where they cover a several county area with home health care aides. It's, I think the last number I saw, it's maybe more now, was 55 women who are home health care aides. And if you know anything about the home health care industry, it's, travel is incredibly time consuming, and it's just really draining work. And it's relatively low pay, and you need a relatively high level of emotional fortitude and training to do it. And there's the biggest cooperative in the U.S. is in the Bronx, and it's 2,500 home health care aides.
Hmm.
And this is 55, and they're spread over a couple counties, and they just have a central office that coordinates it, and then they have regional team leaders that coordinate four or five home health care aides.
Yeah, so that's a regional example, definitely.
Jonathan, I'm wondering, what was your, if you talked about why you wanted to do this, but what was your inspiration, or what sort of was in your background, or have you heard about a co-op that was so great that you decided you wanted to do it?
Yeah, it was really, the business, the idea for the business was first, which was to provide a music store. We feel like there's so many musicians and musically inclined people, whether you're a musician or not, in the area, and yet there isn't a record store within 100 miles. There is very few outlets to buy strings and picks and these sorts of things. And so, you know, we got together, and that was kind of the dream. And then Josh was mentioned, you know, I think being a worker co-op would make a lot of sense. And honestly, that was one of the first times I even thought about the term in a real sense. And then that just started the research. And then, you know, it's kind of like a, you know, just that little mention of it. And then it opens you up to a whole new world of what's possible. And again, I feel like my grandmother owned a pizza shop and a restaurant, and my grandfather on my dad's side was a businessman, and my brothers owned businesses, and I just have that entrepreneurial spirit in me. But I've also, like, again, I'm just so critical of the economy. I felt paralyzed, and it really feels like a way that I can participate in the economy that seems ethical. And so really a eureka moment, I guess, like finding out about co-ops and feeling like we have a sound business plan. and we have a climate that is looking for alternative modes of economic development, and we have very creative people in the region, and it's rural, and so there's resources for us to use in that regard as well. And there are, you know, Joe's organization, and there is a lot of resources out there for co-ops. And so it was intimidating because, you know, as we kind of touched today, you're starting a small business and you're starting a co-op. So you have two different wings that of your business development that you're trying to get off the ground. And that can be a little intimidating. The great thing is there's a lot of resources out there, and you just can't be afraid to ask. And and it's people that feel passionately, and that's kind of the great thing about the model in general, I think, is like everyone has ownership, and the people like Joe that are wanting to help you, it's more than a job for them. And so they're very enthusiastic about the work, and so it helps it helps with the enthusiasm level of doing something that you have a lot of passion about.
And I think that's an important point, is that sort of regardless of how you feel about the current economy, there's a lot of folks who don't have who would love to start a business but don't have all the time or all the skills. And the cooperative model sort of gives you the opportunity to start a business with four or five friends, four or five acquaintances, four or five people that you've sort of found over time in a way that you're like, oh, I'd love to run a business with that person. And it gives you a structure to do so without killing them, I think, and it gives you a structure to like disagree and have arguments, but without, in a way that is productive, in a way that like discussion and arguments are productive. And so I think it really lowers the barrier to entrepreneurship for lots and lots of people. You know, there's actually a 55-person cooperative about to start in Maine. They're buying an Ace Hardware and a pharmacy and a gas station and a grocery store. And these are people who would have never been entrepreneurs. And we talk so much about how do we maximize sort of the entrepreneurial energy in America? And that's really where the wealth comes from. And it's, in many ways, it's very true. But we say we have this our main business model says only 1 in 100 people can be an entrepreneur. Well, and with the cooperative model, you know, 100 out of 100 people can be an entrepreneur and be so effectively.
Yeah, it's an issue in this region that entrepreneurs have not really been encouraged, and so people don't have the skills or know where to start. And then I wondered also, I would think it'd be really different, say if you worked in the mines and you're answering to the man, or you're telling him what, giving it back to him. Did that sort of mindset change to work in a cooperative situation? I mean, do you all do any training with folks on those kinds of things, the interpersonal and personal changes that you might have to make?
Yeah, we do. We definitely will do sort of trainings. We don't do all of those trainings, but there's a broad range, as Jonathan said, of organizations that do those trainings that we can connect people with.
Uh-huh.
But also we will do workshops, you know, having that solid structure of, you know, we're going to agree to disagree, and really this disagreement isn't that important. And so let's just move on and go with a majority vote. How do we use disagreement to be creative? How do we delegate decisions? So even if I don't like the color of that flyer, I didn't have to decide, and I really don't care, actually. So there's all sorts of those tools. I just think that we often say, people are often like, the biggest barrier to developing more cooperatives in the U.S. is cultural. And I feel like we are more cooperative than that in the U.S. and especially in Appalachia. I'm like a pretty big believer in the fact that we all spend most of our time, you know, even if you're not cooperating with your boss at work, you're hopefully, you may be cooperating with your workmates and helping each other out. And you've definitely developed a structure there, even if it's a way to even if you're cooperating to get around the boss, like you're cooperating right. with your workmates.
Right. Yeah, we're not all rugged individualists all the time, for sure.
I mean, even rugged individualists, like rugged individualist farmers, some of the best cooperators in the country, most of the, you know, lots of agricultural cooperatives, because they saw, and I think it's a often like sort of downplayed fact, but in the mainstream economy, there's cooperation all over the place. If you look at sort of the Friends of Coal or the Kentucky Coal Council is an effort of cooperation mm-hmm. among coal companies.
Right.
Right. They probably elect a board.
Right.
You know, if you look at a country club, country clubs are mostly cooperatives. You buy in, you pay annual dues, you elect your board member, they govern the country club. They don't call it a cooperative. In some ways, the idea that we don't cooperate is a myth that we're telling folks from the working people that we don't cooperate. That's bad. That's a myth.
Mm-hmm.
These things have been around for a long time. This isn't some newfangled idea, especially in Italy. And in Spain, there's a co-op that is one of the largest in the world. It's the seventh largest capitalist corporation in Spain. And in the region that it's in, it's the largest corporation there. And it's weathered the recession a lot better than a lot of the other corporations in Spain. It has 80,000 cooperative members. And so it's a cooperative of cooperatives, a bunch of different cooperatives coming together. And the story about that one is that it came out of the Spanish Civil War, out of a place that was completely sort of devastated, and folks sort of rising out of that and deciding to form cooperatives. And Cleveland right now, there's some that are coming together that Cleveland has been hit so hard by the recession and all the industry pulling out. And so there is a precedent of these things having gone on for decades and hundreds of years and rising out of places that have been really hard hit.
Yeah, I think the most interesting example there actually is the Italy, and there's this region called Emilia Romagna. It's mountainous. It was for a long time the main battle line between Allied and Axis troops in World War II, and so the economy was bombed to smithereens. And then after World War II, Italy really abandoned it. The sort of central government in Italy abandoned that part of the region. And so it's not sort of not unlike Eastern Kentucky. And what you see now there is a vibrant cooperative economy where 30 to 50% of the gross domestic product goes through various cooperatives. They have housing cooperatives, worker cooperatives are the largest construction companies. They have a vibrant agricultural cooperative. Like all Parmesan cheese comes from there, and almost all Parmesan cheese is going to come from a cooperative. You may not know it, or maybe some huge ag cooperative that doesn't even say co-op, but. And so really you see a lot, you see the rise of cooperative, big cooperatives like Mondragon, which is in Spain, or of cooperative networks, which I think is an equally applicable model in the U.S., is how do we make a lot of small businesses that are cooperatives that are, you know, competing against each other in the market. Construction co-ops compete against each other for small jobs. There's no rule against two cooperatives competing against each other on a job. But they also cooperate to get larger construction jobs. And, you know, they all sort of help finance each other and make a financing pool. And so really that network effect is like really strong, and I think really appealing in Appalachia.
Yeah, and I think what you know, if we think of co-ops, we do think of a food co-op or maybe a cooperative coffee shop or something. But I understand that some of those in Europe and probably this country are really engaged in heavy industry, manufacturing, and it goes across the board any kind of industry can be a co-op, I gather.
Yeah, with enough access to capital, it's as easy to make, and enough smart business people, it's as easy to make an industrial cooperative and a manufacturing cooperative as it is a coffee shop. That's probably an overstatement, but you can easily do it. There's no inherent barrier. The structures are developed to make democracy meaningful in those settings, but also a functioning business. Mondragon, as they make the machines that make wind turbines, they make rail cars. I think they make bicycles. You know, you see a lot of Mondragon. It's not Mondragon brand bicycles. I can't remember what their bicycle brand is.
I think it's Obera.
That's it.
Very expensive bicycles for really rich people.
I think they make some lower cost models too, but mm-hmm. I think the lower cost models are manufactured in China.
And And just coming up this weekend, there's a big convening down in Jackson, Mississippi called Jackson Rising, of that community deciding to come together, and we want to, them saying, like, we want to explore alternative economies and new economies here with an emphasis on worker co-ops. And so I'll be going to that mostly to sort of try to learn as much as I can and bring it back. And, like, how can we here come together as a community, as a region, to sort of maybe do the same thing, to have this conversation here, and to build on that.
That's great. So they actually are going to focus on Jackson, Mississippi, and the area around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've invited folks from all over the nation to come and participate, but the real focus is about what can we do in Jackson.
Oh, that's exciting. Sounds interesting.
And so that's one resource folks could look up, you know, Jackson Rising, and see the types of things they're offering there. But I'm curious, for folks that are listening that might be interested in this, what are some other, like, a good starting place to go learn a specific resource to go look up to learn about co-ops or starting a co-op?
Yeah, are there some places on the internet, for example, where you can find out more?
All right, yeah. I will be not unshy in saying that usworker.coop, a lot of the co-op sort of, we have our own sort of last three, it's not .com, it's .coop. So usworker.coop, we have sort of a brief introduction. You can look up every worker cooperative in the United States. And then if you go to our institute webpage, which you'll see, it's institute.usworker.coop, it's linked from that website as well. We have a sort of a vast array of resources. And then if you are seriously considering starting a worker co-op, if you've already made the first steps, you can ask for assistance from the Democracy at Work Network, which is a group of people who have already worked in worker cooperatives and have received training in how to work with other people, helping starting them. And that's, I come from that background, and it's a program of the Democracy at Work Institute. And that's dawn.coop, dawn.coop. Cooperation Works, and I couldn't tell you K-Card's website, but if you just Google search K-Card, it's the Kentucky Cooperative Agricultural and Rural Development. I actually don't know what it stands for, but they're really good people. I think those are the ones that I would recommend immediately. Oh, and American.coop is this fellow Joe Marafino runs probably the most thorough compendium of, like, every cooperative news story, every handbook, anything that's ever come out in the last 20 years.
And with my experience, with Google search, I got led to Joe's website really quickly, and the U.S. co-op, what is it again, U.S.coop?
U.S. worker.coop.
U.S. worker.coop has a link to all these resources, and one of them on there was this. I think it's a PowerPoint entitled "Co-op 101." And you know, I get easily intimidated by things, and I went to that PowerPoint, and it was, whoever put it together did a wonderful job, and it really just led you down different examples of co-ops, what's possible, how co-ops fail, how they succeed, more resources, and that was just really a great foundational document for me. And the my fellow co-workers felt the same way.
Well, there are numerous groups in the region that are do entrepreneurial training and different kind of business training, and I think it would really be great if we could get more information about this as one of the alternatives to those organizations, so that they, you know, that they're telling people that they're training as well.
And I'll just say that's one of our programs this year, in our first year at the Democracy at Work Institute, is to work with small business development centers to better equip them to work with worker cooperatives. And the, you know what, now I'm blanking on the name, but a couple things. In Huntington, coming up in early May, the Brighter Futures or Opportunity Futures Small Business Development Center is hosting a woman named Leslie Schaller giving a 2-day worker cooperative introduction.
Wow.
And so if you're in Huntington or want to drive over
it's
to Huntington,
not too far from here,
you could check that out. And she is one of the founders of Casa Nueva, which is a, I think now 20 worker owner, 60 employee. They have a lot of college kids coming through, working there, but restaurant, very successful restaurant in Athens, Ohio, and they're great. And she works with a group called AceNet that helps people, will help people start worker cooperatives in Southern Ohio.
Yeah, they have quite a good reputation for all the things they've done, the food, local food work.
And great burritos.
That's right.
And I think kind of speaking on starting out, and for us, it was kind of overwhelming. Do we reach out for people to help us with small business, or do we first help people, you know, reach out to people to help us with the cooperative aspect? And so we reached out to Joe's organization first, and that's been wonderful. But now we realized we're a little behind the game a little bit in the business development side of things, and so now we'll be kind of switching our hunt for resources to more along of the small business development portion of growing the business.
I think that's a really good point. If you need to be looking for both sort of tools to build the cooperative, and we can help you with, if there's, you know, no one in your region that wants to help work on, with you on small business stuff, we can sort of, we do help with that. But then one thing we also do is help people find lawyers that work well with work with cooperatives, or help lawyers learn how to work with worker cooperatives. Mm-hmm. They're a legal structure that's it's a legal corporate structure, but also people start LLCs and turn them into cooperatives because there's the barriers are so much lower. But and we can help with all of that and help explain worker co-ops. So I think our hope is that we work with people a little bit and then explain worker co-ops to the Small Business Development Center that they're working with. So they're like, oh, that's actually a really sound idea for a resilient business, not, oh, those people may be crazy.
And two, something that was useful in meeting with Joe today is, as I've, and again, I'm speaking from my own experience, not the three other coworkers and owners, but I felt a little paralyzed in that, like, we didn't have a cooperative model in place and to move forward, and it was kind of a relief to find out that just do what you need to do from a business standpoint, because it is a business, and to not let not having how it's going to be democratic, or how it's going to, you know, how it's going to be structured and who's going to be members, who's not going to be members, to not let that trip you up, to kind of surge forward with your business and do the things that you naturally need to do. You need to buy stuff, you need to set up relationships, you need to make decisions, and to kind of go forward with that stuff, and then you know, just keep chugging away with the cooperative aspect. Uh-huh. And it'll kind of come into place.
Yeah, and I think that's really important to say, that the cooperative development cycle is a cycle, just like the business development cycle is a cycle, and you're going to do both, hopefully, through the life of your business. Look at, how do we make this a better co-op, and how do we make this a better business? I would say these guys have a really aggressive opening date, because they're going to be open for Sea Time in the Cumberlands.
All right.
June 6th is their targeted opening date, so stop by.
I'm sure they'll do well. Well, this has been a great discussion, and, you know, I think that some of the examples, like of the workers in a grocery store, you know, being able to keep that open and take it over as a business and run it as a cooperative, really resonate, because we've seen, you know, so many in our small towns, our businesses disappear, and every business that goes, a bit of our town goes, and that is a model to keep these things going, as well as starting new businesses. Is really, really wonderful. We have so many beautiful little communities that with empty storefronts and empty offices, and we need to fill them up.
And I will say, and one of the biggest things that is allowing us to move forward with any of this is just having an affordable rent.
Uh-huh.
So that was a large part of what is allowing all the co-op and the small business and economic development to happen, is having a rent that's manageable, that even if we aren't financially successful out of the gates will still be able to meet the rent, to be able to hopefully down the road be successful. So, you know, just something, just that one piece was a really big one.
And I imagine that's a bit of a challenge in the big cities, rent costs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a challenge. I mean, it's no more challenging for a co-op than for any other small business.
Yeah.
But you see a lot of people be very, very creative about how they use space.
Yeah. Well, and then there's the housing cooperatives, and I guess there could be cooperatives that had rental properties, rental units too. So just, I just one more question. Do you think that the kind of our American economic system, do you know the powers that be think that co-ops threaten them and the kind of the capitalist system as we know it today?
No, I mean, I think one interesting thing is that I was thinking about this on the way over here, and I think fundamentally most of us agree about where we want to be. We want strong communities. We want a thriving small business network. We want, you know, educated people and opportunities for people who work full time to have really decent wages and have a decent life. Like, I don't think there's a lot of disagreement in the U.S. about where we want to be many times. It's about how we get there. And I really think that cooperatives bridge that gap really well. You know, we can remember George Bush talking about the ownership society, and every time I heard him say ownership society, I was like, yeah, ownership society. We want everyone to own a small business as a cooperative, everyone to own a medium or large business, and that to be cooperative. And not that every business needs to be a cooperative, but like, it's really about from a sort of entrepreneurship and enterprise perspective, yes, it's the market can be a pretty amazing place to trade and do business and sort of can spur innovation. But the question is, how are you going to innovate for a broader audience? Right now, so much innovation is about how do we innovate wealth up or out of communities, but how do we, and the question really that the cooperative asks is, how are we going to innovate wealth into communities? So no, I think it doesn't threaten markets. It doesn't threaten sort of the fundamental American fabric. I don't think any of that. If fundamental American fabric is about creating opportunity for many people, it doesn't threaten that. If it's about creating more and more wealth extracted from communities, well, it maybe threatens that, but uh-huh. It's okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We've had Joe Reinhardt here today from Democracy at Work Network and Jonathan Hoopman from Whitesburg KY, starting a new business with the help of the network, and Sarah Pennington, also from here in Whitesburg, who is exploring and researching these issues of co-ops as a possibility or part of redeveloping this region. And we just thank you all for being on Mountain Talk.
Thank you so much, Mimi.
You're welcome.